You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate
and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world.
And now, innovation thought leader
and your super fly host,
Tamara Kleinberg.
Launch Street, what's up? Wow, I love my work. Today's interview was super interesting. Richard Fertig stopped by and he left nothing back. So aside from his incredible optimism and ability to see opportunities everywhere, I think you're going to get a lot out of listening to his personal journey, all the ups and the downs. He is also a master of making money with Airbnb, aka turning the assets you've got into cash. So sit back and enjoy this ride. I mean, interview. Richard, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm very much looking forward to digging into this conversation.
Thank you, Tamara. It's my pleasure.
So I actually want to start with your personal story because I think there's a lot of triumphs and also a few hardships in there that I'd love the listeners to hear because I think, you know, we're not alone in these stories and that's important to know. So will you share your journey?
Absolutely. So let me start. I think it's a little bit different than many, although there's probably some that are similar. Insofar as I'm the first college-educated person in my family. Wow. My father was an entrepreneur. He grew up extremely poor. He was born in 1926, which was the Great Depression. And he became an entrepreneur after the Army, did reasonably well and started traveling. And that was sort of his education, if you will. And he moved down to Costa Rica, met a lovely lady that turned out to be my mother. And so I was actually born and raised in Costa Rica until I was about 10, at which point it was time to become, you know, like get the education that my father never had. And so we moved to New York, both for his business and my education. And, you know, as being the first educated person in my family, he took great pride in it. And it was something that like was a something of pride and distinguishment. And so I went to private school in New York City. And then I was fortunate enough to be accepted at Cornell University, so like an Ivy League institution. Later, I got a second Ivy League degree at graduating from Wharton with an MBA in finance. And I used that to go work on Wall Street. That was always my desire. My father was super cool, even though he was an entrepreneur. He didn't pressure me into taking over the family business. And I always respected that. And I always look back on that now and say, like, I wonder what my life would have been like right. if I had been sort of like that second
totally
generation.
Totally different.
Yeah, totally. And that's so often the path of the entrepreneur is you build something and you either take great pride in it or you can't sell it and you just pass it down to the next generations. And, you know, my dad was really cognizant that his dream might not necessarily be mine. And my dream was to like make it on my own and recognize that he gave me a great education and was always there for me and so on. But like, I wanted to prove my own abilities for myself. And I was always drawn to Wall Street, living in New York City and finance and the money that could be made there. And I went to Wharton and got an MBA. I was recruited by a firm that's extremely successful called the Blackstone Group. And I was the first associate hired into their fund of hedge funds, which at the time was about $1 billion. And it was the principals, the founders' money. They hired myself and a few other people to help them invest in a diversified global approach of alternative assets. And basically what that means is I was researching risk and reward, where the most reward would be for the least amount of risk and moving their capital all over the world and in commodities and stocks and bonds and you name it. And that went really well. We did extremely well. And I was recruited by a competing firm called Ramius Capital Group. I was the fourth person to join there. And they had about $100 million of the principal's money at that point. And by the time I left, about 10 years later, we had over 50 people. We were running a portfolio of $4 billion. Wow. Again, all global, and I rose to be co-head of investments. And, you know, it was a really exciting ride. I traveled the world. I met a ton of incredible people, including, you know, people that we see and read about, like Carl Icahn and all these billionaire investors, and was learning from them. And in 2007, as the world started to really accelerate into high returns, we started to get a little bit nervous, and what we sort of predicted would happen did in fact happen in 2008. But given the fact that we were investing in hedge funds, it's quite challenging to move that ship. There's lockups and illiquidity. And so we weren't able to move as quickly as we would have liked, although, you know, we generated less losses and we beat all of our competitors and so on. Nobody likes to lose money. And one thing I learned, and this should be a lesson, you never want to be a co-head of anything in a downsizing environment.
That's right.
Yeah. There's like two people doing the same job. Yeah. And so while it feels great on the ride up, on the way down, it's not great. And so although we went through rounds and rounds of laying people off and all these people that we had, you know, recruited and begged and pleaded and, you know, brought this amazing team together, I found myself in this really unknown and uncharted territory where you have to start to dismantle your baby. And it's kind of interesting if you think about it. There's millions of books written about how to grow a business and how to build a team and how to lead a team and how to do all. I have yet to see a book about like dismantling your team.
Yeah, I don't know that we think about that.
And so it was completely foreign and uncharted, and the markets were absolutely insane. And I just remember walking in and looking at the Bloomberg with my mouth wide open and just could not believe how bad it was and how big the losses were in the market. And in fact, there was a moment at the low where I just was like, I can't, you know, money is worthless, everything is worthless, nothing has any value at all. And so I just took whatever money I had, liquid, and I invested in my kids' 529 college plan. It was sort of like, it's worthless anyway, and maybe this will have some worth in the future. And it turns out I literally bought the low. So right. Like that worked out. You know, like when I threw in the towel, wow. It was the low. And so that was a great return, and it's going to be helping their college fund. But long story short, after laying off several dozen people in the team and going through this hardship, I thought I was on the inside track.
You were safe.
Well, I thought I was like on the boat, and the boat might be getting smaller and smaller and smaller.
But you're still on it.
But I thought I was like, you know, involved in captaining the ship. And I was until I got tapped on the shoulder one morning on a Monday morning, first trading day of January 2009, January 5th. And the other co-head and I were leading the discussion, our team meeting. We were trying to get everybody to feel like the worst was behind and let's get optimistic. 2009 is a new year. You know, our returns are done. Now think about it as a blank slate and opportunity. And we got passed a note saying, you know, our boss basically wanted to see us. And we both looked at, you know, the assistant and said, like, now? We're in the middle of a meeting. And she said, yeah, now. And we exited the room. And we looked at each other and we knew we were done, and basically we were dismissed. So I spent 8 years of my life building this team and this fund and generating these returns and flying all over the world. And literally, like a snap of your fingers, it was over. And to be completely transparent, I didn't see it coming at all.
Yeah.
You know, like even though we were laying tons of people off and I saw like all the blood in the streets and the losses and the withdrawals and I saw all that. Never for a second did I think, you know, like my job is uncertain.
Yeah. You know, I think you're not alone in that. I think a lot of people in 2008, beginning of 2009, thought this is really bad, but I'll be okay.
Yeah.
And then that changed.
Well, and I also think, you know, I was co-head of investments and I don't know, maybe I took too much pride in that and thought that I was involved in like righting the ship and, but whatever, you know, these things happen. And I think one of the things that I often like to say is I'm eternally optimistic. So even though we were in crisis mode and things were awful, I thought I would be okay. And I thought I could be helpful in growing and rebounding and so on. Right. Like I never had that internal doubt or say like, gee, is this my fault? Or maybe I'm at risk. Maybe I should develop some of that, but I always try and find the positive.
So you're now out of work. So what do you do next?
You know, it was really, really the most amazing period of time in the sense that there was absolutely nothing that one could do. If you were in finance and you were looking for a job in finance in 2009, it's impossible to imagine the frustration. I networked like mad. I turned it into a full-time job. I spoke to everybody that ever had recruited me before and all the people that we had invested in.
Nobody was hiring.
Well, you know what the interesting thing was? Everybody took the meeting because they were, you know, previously really interested in speaking with me or encouraging me to come over. So I had all these meetings, but the most frustrating thing was I couldn't even get a no. Because I think they wanted to hire me.
Right.
But they didn't know if they had a job, or if their fund would be in business, or if their firm was going out of business, or if they, you know, like they didn't know anything. And so, you know, if you're eternally optimistic or you're in sales, you know, a no is almost as good as a yes, because you know if you get enough no's, eventually you get to a yes.
Yeah, right.
Right. But I wasn't even getting the no's. And so I was just circling around. And so what I did was I started to run. My dog and I started running down the Hudson River, and I'm not a great runner, but we started getting into shape and running longer and further. And I started to think, and that was really, you know, sort of cathartic and calming. And, you know, I looked forward to it and I started to think. And, you know, what I realized in that period of time was that this was a journey and a process, and I was meant to go through it, and there was something to learn, and there was an opportunity. And that the, you know, reliance of other people to take a risk and hire me was sort of cowardly, right?
Oh. Like
that I should, how can I ask somebody else to hire me and pay me, like give me a W-2 if I wouldn't do that for myself?
That's an interesting way to look at it.
Yeah, that I should believe in myself more than anyone else, right?
Yeah.
And so once I started to think about that and think about sort of my father – and you know, he was ill at that point, and we lost him shortly after I launched my first business. But I was kind of like, you know, there's something here. I'm supposed to be thinking about this stuff, and this is an opportunity, again, eternally optimistic. And ultimately I decided, that I was going to take the summer off. I got laid off in January. I networked like mad until, you know, call it May or June, and was running and thinking through things. And by like the summer, I said, you know what? There's really nothing here. I don't know exactly what I'm going to do, but I'm going to move out to my house out in the Hamptons, and I'm going to take a little bit of time and like think about it and figure it out. And within, call it 30 days of being out there, I was committed to being an entrepreneur and what I was going to do. I knew I was going to do something entrepreneurial before I went to the Hamptons, and I had a discussion with my wife, my ex-wife at this point. But I had no idea what it would be like. And, you know, that was an interesting conversation where one day she came home and I said, hey, I've got really great news. And she said, oh, great. And, you know, in like her mind, I'm sure it was like, you got a job,
a J-O-B.
Right? Yeah, you got a job. That's fantastic. We're going to be okay. And she said, okay, well, what's the great news? And I said, you know, I've decided that I'm going to hire myself. And she said, what do you mean? And I said, well, you know, I want to be an entrepreneur. And she said, oh, and you think the timing is right now? Like the world is blowing up. Nobody's hiring. Nobody's spending any money. And you think the timing is right now? And I said, well, you know, historically, I've made really great investments and trades being a contrarian, right? Like I sell when other people are buying and I buy when other people are selling, and distressed opportunities are really profitable. And so I kind of think right now might be a decent time. And she said, oh, well, I don't know that I agree, but tell me more. What is your company going to do? And I said, you know, that's just it. I have no idea.
I'll get to that part.
Yeah. She said, wait a minute. Like, this is supposed to be good news. You're going to start a company in the worst crisis the country's ever seen since the Great Depression. And you also have no idea what it's going to do. And I'm supposed to be happy about this? And I said, well, yeah, you know, like, thanks for the support. I really, you know, I'm committed to this and I'm going to figure it all out.
You know, I have to stop you for a second. You've said a few things that I think are so important that I just want to make sure that listeners are paying attention to. One is, you know, you said you had kind of stopped and said, all right, I'm just going to sit in this. I'm going to think about it, because this is a journey. And it is incredible to me the power of just not necessarily white knuckling it, looking for a solution, but actually just being okay thinking about it and just letting it come a little bit and figuring it out, which is, sounds like a little bit what you did when you said, I'm going to go live in the Hamptons for a little while and just
Absolutely.
Like sit with myself.
You know, and I just filmed a video. We can get to it a little bit later. And it's exactly what you're talking about, because half the people, or maybe 75% of the people, think that I never work, I travel a lot. I'm skiing. I'm doing all sorts of things. And they're like, I don't get it. Are you retired? You never work. And then the people that actually know me really, really well know that I'm working like nonstop, 24/7. And part of that working is carving out those periods of introspection and deep thought and not pushing it, right? Like I might go skiing and that's what the world sees. And I may have no thoughts on a given day, but the next day or 2 days later on the chairlift, I'll have some idea that, you know, represents the future for what I'm working on. And that is work. For me, that's work.
You know, it's I did a video on this recently about it. So the subconscious mind is 20 times more active if you shut down the conscious. Like if that's not yelling at you, the subconscious mind can actually get to work. So I'm with you. I just took the dog today for a 2-hour walk, which I'm sure my neighbors are, because I was working from home today, I'm sure my neighbors are like, does Tamara ever do anything besides exercise and walk her dog?
Right.
But in all those moments, I really am thinking. It's just not at my desk in front of a computer at a cubicle.
That's exactly right. And that's the whole like point behind like transcendental meditation and so on, right? Is just to like free your conscious mind from obligatory responsibility and thoughts and linear thinking and just let it be.
So I want to now dig into a little bit about what you were just saying about the response you got, because I know a lot of us experience this when whether that's we're going to be an entrepreneur or we just have a crazy idea that we want to pursue. I think oftentimes the response that we get from people who, you know, love us and mean to support us, whether that's, you know, spouses or family or friends or colleagues, is surprisingly, I don't know how to say it, mediocre. at best. I mean, how did you deal with that? How did that make you feel? What did you do to kind of overcome that resistance in that moment when you're super excited and the response you get is lukewarm at best?
Yeah, I think that that's a challenge. It continues to be a challenge, and it continues, therefore, in my mind, to be an opportunity in the following sense. Previously, I really looked for external validation of what I was doing. And I had a lens, if you will, as like a Wharton MBA, a hedge fund guy, married, successful, kids. Yeah, like
that's
all
quite
those,
the profile.
Yeah, like all of these labels, right? Like in this turmoil, what I recognized was I'm actually none of those things, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's a discrete point, with the exception of being a father. Everything else is like a point in time and a label that other people put on me to understand what it is that I'm doing. And I identified with that, right? So like I would be less than honest if I said I didn't identify as that Wharton hedge fund guy in 2007 riding a bull market, right? Like that's who I was.
Yeah.
But I'm the same person really in the crash in 2009. Even if I don't have that job, right? Like my mind is the same. My intention is the same. My goodwill is the same. My ethics are the same. And so that label is just a label. And so the answer to your question is I've become much more mindful and respectful that like my journey is an individual journey. And as long as I'm finding personal satisfaction and I'm moving forward and I'm doing the things that I want to do in the ways that I want to do them and I'm helping people in the way that I want, I don't need that external validation. And in fact, in my newest like iteration, and I continue to evolve and so on, you know, what I'm doing is even way more out there and far fewer people get it. And like, I'm okay with that.
So talk to me a little bit about what that is. What are you doing? I mean, we talked a little bit offline, but for the listeners, what are you doing now? And if you wouldn't mind sharing the story we were talking about the conversation you had last night around it, because it's pretty funny.
Sure. Yeah. So let me just bridge the gap for a second and close that loop. So in 2010, I basically launched my very first business. It was called Brilliant Transportation. It's still in business today. We've evolved over some time. But I basically launched the most expensive and the highest end luxury ground transportation business, first in New York, and then we expanded to Los Angeles. And so I created the most upscale, like private jets on wheels. I innovated the whole like Mercedes Sprinter concept, which is now quite popular. But in 2010, I owned the only 10 that were in operation for hire. And like I put all my money into it and I started it up and I didn't know anything about transportation or logistics or operations or chauffeur training or hospitality or anything. And I was just like, there's an opportunity. I know there's people that have money that would like to travel like this. And so I'm going to create it. And so I went out and I did all of that. And, you know, we created a multi-million dollar company. Like I said, it continues to operate today. But that was my idea, and I muscled through it, and you know, it's very successful and continues to operate. And then subsequent to that, I realized I was always involved in real estate through just a bunch of, you know, random facts. I was introduced to somebody who was using their like spare bedroom on Airbnb, and I thought they were crazy. I'd heard about it, but I was like, no, you know, real people don't do that. And as it turned out, you know, it piqued my interest, and I had an apartment that I was renting out long-term in New York City. And when I got back from that trip, my broker was like, let's lower the price. It didn't rent, and we're missing the right season. And if we don't lower it now, we're going to
– Oh, my gosh. I lived in New York City for many years. I know exactly what you're talking about, the panic of we got to do it right now.
Yeah. And so I turned to, again, my wife at the time, my ex-wife now, and I said, listen, you know, I just heard about this great thing. I'm sure you've heard about it too, but like a real person's doing it and they're having success and they're enjoying it. And so why don't we like furnish the apartment and we'll go ahead and list it and we'll be entrepreneurs with our apartment. And again, I was much more comfortable, but she was so frustrated with the broker and the like lowering the price yet again and whatever. She was like, okay, just don't spend a lot of money doing it. And that sort of launched like the next version of what I started doing, which was I became really involved in Airbnb. We were having a lot of success with it, and we started buying properties. I call this my 15-year plan. And in a nutshell, my 15-year plan is I go out and I acquire properties in locations that I love and locations that have meaning to me where I want to spend more time. And I buy properties there with a 15-year mortgage. We're at record lows right now, so it's more affordable than ever. And I put them out on Airbnb, and at this point I have a small portfolio of properties that are investment properties that generate income that, because I have so many of them, I can't be in any of them more than my life allows. And so they basically pay for themselves, and in 15 years I own these outright, and then it's just a perpetual like annuity of retirement income. And I've automated the whole thing, so I have people, you know, working with me and managing the calendars, and we've created, you know, property cleaning teams and so on. And so I've become this entrepreneur, a real estate investor / business entrepreneur on Airbnb and HomeAway. And that's been going extremely well. So we continue to add properties. We reinvest in new properties. And then about a year ago, I thought, you know, this is working really well. Am I the only one doing this? And started riffing with one of my coworkers who's a younger millennial. And Charles was like, well, you know, we should start educating people on it. And we decided to do that. And so we started with YouTube. And now we have the fastest growing channel on YouTube about Airbnb hosting tips and how to be an entrepreneur in real estate and on Airbnb. And it's been just so incredibly rewarding from my perspective to like help people. I get comments every single day like, you've changed my life and you've given me an opportunity and I want to be an entrepreneur and I've just bought my second property, or I'm going to start small and do what you're doing. Whatever it is, it's just so incredibly rewarding to share the experience that I have. And so to your point about what we talked about earlier, I tweeted out earlier today that, you know, I was at a meeting last night where there was a bunch of Wharton MBAs, and when they asked me what I did, partly for the shock value and partly because it's like what I feel most close to right now, I said, I'm a YouTuber.
And they were like, what?
Yeah. I mean, they didn't even know where to go with that. They had no idea. And what I tweeted this morning was that response tells me I'm on the right path, right? Like there's opportunity here. When the Wharton MBAs don't quite get it, that's good.
What I love about that too is to link it back to what you said earlier, that is really proof of the fact that your identity is coming from the inside, not the outside. And for those listening, I'd really encourage you to think about where your identity is coming from, because it is a fragile thing if you're not the one who really owns it. And if it's coming from the outside.
It's so true. And in fact, in the interest of full like transparency and being vulnerable and just being out there and I don't know how many people are going to listen to this or where they're going to listen to it. But, you know, another challenge that I had, and you wanted me to talk about the ups and the downs, yeah, is about a year ago, we separated. My wife of 24 years,
wow,
basically, you know, I guess changed her mind, if you want to call it that. And so we separated. And like that was a major part of my identity. If you think a career is a major part of your identity, think about like, you know,
your marriage of
25 years is part of your identity. And so like that was kind of a shocker too. And, you know, it's been about a year and I'm so excited and upbeat, and it allows me to do things that I wouldn't do otherwise. Like I'm reinventing how I live and where I live. And it's just, it's an incredible opportunity, as painful as it is. And I would never wish it on anyone. And like, don't go blow up your marriage just because you heard me say it's great. But you know, like I think what many people would do is sort of stay in like the same track that they were on, just say like I'm separated or divorced and stay in the same city and stay in the same like job and so on. And so I've sort of looked at it and said, again, well, this is part of my journey. I don't know what the lesson here is, but I'm going to make sure that I pay attention to my instinct. I'm going to give myself the freedom. And so what I'm sort of working on this, again, I own properties in different places, is a more nomadic lifestyle. My kids are going to boarding school.
Very cool.
And so I don't have to be in New York City per se. I can be here when I want. I want to be here for them when they're here. But, you know, I might move out west for a month at a time. And I might go – I'm working on an Airbnb project in Bali.
Oh.
And so there's just like things that come out of the woodwork where when you open your mind – and you think creatively and you don't confine yourself to like the lens that you used to know, if you're bold enough, you can do it, right? And like that's where I'm finding a lot of strength and excitement and energy. And so some people, you know, again, looking at the old lens, are like, oh, what's Richard running away from? Like he's running away from his old life or from New York City or whatever. And they couldn't be more wrong. That's sort of like, does Richard ever work? What's actually happening is I'm running towards something.
God, what a great reframe too for people who are really frustrated with where they are. Because I do think that when we're stuck in a rut, whatever that rut is, we tend to think of it as how do I get away from that, versus what you're saying, which is how do I move towards this, right? Because this is what I want in life.
Well, one of them is very passive, and you're the victim.
Yeah.
And the other one is very proactive, and you're following your like dreams, and it's empowering.
It's so empowering. So I have so many questions for you, and I want to dig into Airbnb a little bit because from the entrepreneurial perspective, I think that's fascinating. Before we do that, I want to ask you one question. You've said that you're eternally optimistic several times, I think, in this conversation. And I'm curious not just where that comes from, but how you think that's really helped get you where you are today and really launch into that more entrepreneurial life and the different stages that you've been through.
Yeah, well, I think it probably comes from the fact that I was raised in an entrepreneurial home, and my father, like I said, was born during the Great Depression, extremely poor, lost his parents at a very early age, and was basically orphaned and became self-reliant and was the American dream. He was successful. And so like that story, that life, I think permeated through like everything that we did, was kind of like, you can do anything. There is no limits or bounds. You know, my father didn't have an Ivy League education. He didn't go work at the Blackstone Group. He just hustled, and he was smart, and he took risks. And so I grew up in an environment where not only was that encouraged, but that was like reality. And I remember in 1987, I was in private school. He had a bunch of investments in the stock market, and he had a small business. And he almost went bankrupt when the market crashed. And you know, we had a discussion as a family. It's like, listen, things are going to change. We're going to try and keep you in school. You know how much I value your school, but like there's some really bad things happening. And the crash in 1987 was just enormous. I mean, people like jumped out of windows. Yeah, and
I remember.
And, you know, it was like, it was a big deal. And, you know, I remember watching this man who like worked his whole life and almost lost everything and just said, we're going to buckle down a little bit, but we're going to be just fine. And he never wavered. There was never any doubt. It was just sort of like, okay, well, this is part of the journey, so let's make the best of it. And how do we get through it? And of course, not only did we get through it, but we came out stronger, and I'm sure he learned some lessons and he applied them. And so I think that's probably where I get it, and I'm really grateful, and that's probably worth 1,000 times more than any Ivy League education or degree. But I think that that's just the lens that I view the world through. And when things get tough, I'm mindful. A friend of mine teaches mindfulness, and I don't have a lot of experience in it, but basically what I took away from it was your mind can have one thing on its mind at a time. It can be negative or it can be positive. You can't think of 7,000 things at once. And so you train yourself, like when you see yourself going to a negative place, identify that trigger, say like, oh, I'm getting negative, and redirect and go somewhere positive. Either a totally different off-topic thing for me, or what is the positive learning experience in this negative pain that I'm feeling? A lot of people, when they feel pain, will self-medicate through drugs or alcohol or go get social
Netflix.
Or do like whatever, right? Yeah, whatever it is, like whatever your remedy is so that you don't feel all that pain so much. And for me, you know, I don't do any of that. And I actually like, I want to feel that emotion. I want to understand what I'm feeling. And once I've had enough of it, then I say, okay, time to redirect, get mindful, let's get positive. And it works. I mean, it may sound kooky, but it works.
Well, and for launch readers out there, what I'm hearing Richard say is it's not that you're looking through rose-colored glasses and not clear about what's happening around you or reality. It's how you decide to deal with reality. And I think that is what's so powerful about the story you're sharing is it's not that you're ignoring it or in denial or oh, everything's fine. It's not fine. It sucks. And now I'm going to figure out a solution to make it better.
Absolutely. And I think even deeper than that, it's like I want to feel that pain, right? Like I want to embrace it for a period of time until it's like not healthy. I want the raw emotion. I don't want it like, you know, sugar-coated. Let's just feel what that feels like. And what do I learn from that feeling? How can I avoid this again? Like, what can I learn from this? And what I find is optimism. Like once you can embrace your darkest fears and lose like identity. Okay, I'm not a hedge fund guy. Okay, I'm not married. Okay, and say, but you know what? I'm still that really good guy that means well and wants to educate people and wants to grow a business and be a great father. And then you're kind of like, okay, well, nobody can take that away.
No, it's so cool. And I got to say, I know we're going to switch over to Airbnb and talk a little bit about that. But I want to say for those listening, like I feel a little bit like my mind's blown in the mindset side of it. And that is so much a part of being an innovator and getting out there and making things happen is having the right mindset to be able to do it. So let's flip a little bit. Let's talk about Airbnb because I think it's fascinating what Airbnb, Uber, all of these companies have done to open up the opportunity to be entrepreneurial for the everyday person. And you talk a lot about how you think it's just an incredible opportunity for anyone to be an entrepreneur. Why is Airbnb and what you've been able to do, why is that so great for people?
So let's just start by saying I spend a lot of time thinking forward. That's one of the things that I think has helped me in life and in entrepreneurial stuff. I try and forecast, if you will. And to your point about having that right mindset, you have to be willing to be wrong, right? Like you have to be comfortable being wrong, and you have to like reward being wrong. So in some of my entrepreneurial ventures, I'll have contests with employees and reward who's wrong. Because if we
that's
can't
fantastic.
Like, if we can't embrace like taking chances and risk, then you're not innovating.
Yeah.
Then
and
you're just staying within the bounds.
You are. And I just want to stop for a second because I love that you are rewarding people for being wrong. It is one of the things that drives me a little bit bonkers, and you see it all the time of, you know, oh yeah, no, we love innovation. We're all about taking risks. But when it's time to actually try something, people they clinch up. And they don't actually reward or recognize the failures or the things that are wrong that actually help you to get to the good places.
Exactly. And so to answer your question about Airbnb and Uber specifically, you know, I launched my company at the very high end, Brilliant Transportation, in 2010 at or about the same time that Travis launched Uber.
Right.
And clearly, based on market valuation, he was right and I was wrong. Right?
So some people just nail it.
Yeah. But the point is what I watched, I had a first row seat in like disruption, consumer behavior changing, entrepreneurialism. And the thing that many people may think about, but probably not enough, is Uber's not just a convenient way to get from like A to B.
Yeah.
Uber has changed consumer behavior and transportation for like ever, right?
Yeah.
Like you're going to start to see people buying fewer and fewer cars. There's going to be less and less need for people to live in cities because they could now live further away and some electronic Tesla or Ford picks them up and they can sleep in the car. So once the genie's out of the bottle, it's not going back in, and it's massively disruptive. And I think the same opportunity exists for Airbnb. And that becomes like the way that I think of my properties on Airbnb is that every asset must pay for itself. I no longer have a sunk cost for like a home that can just sit empty or that I must live in. Like I must live in this one home because I own it. Or well, when I'm not using my vacation home, it just sits empty, or I'll try and use it
right.
as much as possible.
Which is just such a waste of space, really.
Right. It's now like I'm in the process of buying a place in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. I'm only looking at places that are legal to be Airbnb'd so that I don't have any like regulatory risk. And I'm going to spend as much time as I possibly can there because I love to ski and hike and be outdoors.
Because it's Jackson Hole.
Because it's Jackson Hole, right. But when I'm not there, I'm going to Airbnb it. And so like my thinking has changed, and I'm going to have personal artifacts there, but they're not going to be like, you know, really, really super important or really, really rare. They're going to be sort of like, you know, make my place mine, but also shareable. And I'm going to keep doing that. Right. And so I might be early to this trend, but I believe looking forward that my kids' generation, that's going to be the way they own a home or multiple homes. And the thing that's so great about Airbnb is everybody listening to this podcast has a roof over their head. And even if they don't have a spare bedroom or even a spare like house, they go away. You know, you're going to your aunt's wedding or whatever.
Hey, well, why not fund your aunt's wedding?
Exactly. Literally. I take 2 weeks off in August and I go fishing. Okay, well, why is your house sitting empty?
You know,
trip.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. The whole thing is fascinating to me. But what you're saying is so important around once the genie's out of the bottle, it has changed how we live and our behavior and our expectations. I have friends now who travel, they do Airbnb travel, but they do it with host families. They don't do it when the houses are empty because they love connecting with locals in the different countries that they go and learning about them along the way. It has completely changed how they travel. So on one hand, you've got these entrepreneurs on one side making a living and opening up their home to people. And on the other hand, totally changing how people experience the world.
It's completely true. And I just stayed at a shared place in Jackson Hole and made a friend and potentially an investor. Like literally, you know, I'm writing a book about this 15-year plan and Airbnb and sort of a little bit about my journey and stuff. And you know, I met this person and told them a little bit about what I'm up to. And next thing you know, it's like, well, you know, should we be maybe investing in something together? And my new thing, which is like I had never contemplated before. I used to have a partner in my wife, and we invested in everything together in that sounding board. But I never had external partners. I never raised money in Brilliant Transportation. I never did a co-deal in real estate. And now, because of this Airbnb sort of sharing and this vision, and everything is about like there's no scarcity. It's abundance, right? It's an abundance-based model. I've partnered on a variety of different real estate deals, on a variety of development deals. And it's just really, really amazing where, again, just opening up my identity and thinking through a different lens and seeing different opportunities, it's just leading to more and more opportunities. And that's why I'm talking about this stuff in the book that I'm writing and on the YouTube channel. And it's really resonating. Like we're really changing people's lives. Whether I'll give you a great story. The person who does my filming for me, Charles, he does my filming and my editing. And in doing that, he was kind of like, well, do you think I might, you know, be able to Airbnb? And I said, sure. He said, yeah, but I'm on a 6-story walk up. I said, okay. He said, and I don't have like a spare bedroom. I said, okay. And I'm out near the subway. I said, okay. He said, so would anybody stay there? I said, Charles, you signed a 1-year lease, bro. So did the people above you and below you and to the left of you and to the right of you. Like, of course people would stay there.
Right.
And he's like, well, You think somebody would stay in like a fold-out couch? I said, yes, at the right price they would.
Right, exactly.
So then he said, you know, one of the things that I'm a big believer in from Simon Sinek is like, what's your why? Like, find your why.
Yeah.
So that when things go tough, you don't just like default to like, well, I'm making money. Because you could go make money at Starbucks,
yep,
right, if you wanted to be a barista. But I said, what's your why? He said, you know, I'm getting married, so I'd like to pay for my wedding. I can't afford my wedding. He said, I'm going to do this couch thing and pay for my wedding. Guess what? He paid for his wedding. He paid for his honeymoon. Now he's saving up for his first property. It's not going to be for the place that he and his wife are going to live in. It's going to be an investment property. And he's a super host and he loves it. And it's like changed his life.
You know, it's, I was listening to an interview and I can't remember the, I know it was a Tim Ferriss interview, but I can't remember the name of the person he was interviewing. It's a Silicon Valley investor. And he had said that one of the biggest mistakes he made was passing up Airbnb because, and Uber, both of them actually, because he thought, oh, I mean, but something could go wrong. Someone could get killed. You know, like there are weird people out there. But the truth is 99.9% of the experiences are actually really great and people are good. And the whole concept has just opened up new opportunities for a lot, to your point, a lot of people around the world.
Yeah. Look, I genuinely believe that, and I'm eternally optimistic. That said, on the YouTube channel, we talk about like signs to avoid and follow your gut and how to know, you know, like we're not going to just say blindly, like just accept that everyone's great. There's, you know, there's a method to the madness. I've learned an awful lot. I think I do it pretty well. Lots of people following sort of the same free tips on the YouTube channel are doing really well and making more money. And, you know, like one of the biggest tips, I just, you know, it comes naturally to me, maybe because I'm an entrepreneur, maybe because I was in finance. But one of the most common mistakes I see is people charge too little.
Really?
So, yeah. So like if you were running a business and you've got innovators listening to this podcast, pricing strategy is critically important. And yet for the person who doesn't really know much about Airbnb or is just getting started or whatever, they've got the wrong metric. The metric that they look at is like occupancy rate. Well, you know, I could price my apartment at 2 cents and I'd be sold out 365 days a year.
Right, but not making any cash.
Right, doing all the hard work.
Yeah.
And saying like I'm on Airbnb and it sucks. Like, oh my God, it's so much work. And I made, you know, $7 this year. But that's the common mistake. People just don't know how to charge and what to do about it. And so there's a lot of things that you can do to optimize this and make it really successful. And in my case, it's led to having, like I said, a 15-year plan with a portfolio of homes in places that are meaningful to me that I like to go and spend time and I want to spend more time. And in 8 more years or however many more years on some of these different mortgages, I'm going to own them outright and they're just going to generate like free cash flow and there's my retirement.
I love it. So I have to ask, which is your favorite tip, at least that you recently have put on your YouTube channel? I have the one, my favorite of the videos I watched, which I'll tell you in a second, but I'd love to hear what your favorite tip is. The one that you think maybe it's the most valuable or just one that's like, if you do this, it's going to be great.
So assuming that people are already hosting, I think that the one thing that I sort of gravitated towards early and it served me really well, and a lot of people like don't think about it. And then there's also some pushback. So like, I know we're doing something well when there's some resistance to it.
Yeah.
And that tip is to ask for the 5-star review. And what I mean by that is it's community-based, and also Airbnb's search engine optimization is based on like the number of 5-star reviews you get. They're obviously going to put people that rank better by the community higher up in the search listings versus the people that get like 1-star reviews. And yet, a lot of people don't know how important that is. Like a guest coming in from Germany, you know, they may not have ever given a 5-star review on anything. And for them, a 3-star review is like a home run. And so when I communicate with them, I set the stage and say, look, I really care about you. I really care about your stay. I want you to have a great time. And I hope that I earn your 5-star review. And if you feel like I've gone out of my way and made it so that you have a great stay, I'd really appreciate your 5-star review. And it's critical that you put that 5-star.
Right.
A lot of people say like, yeah, a lot of people say, give me a great review. Again,
yes.
three stars was a great review.
Well, I used to laugh, you know, because I lived in New York for many years, as we were talking about. And if you asked me on a scale of 1 to 5, the New Yorker and me would be like, a 3. And that's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Like nothing's a 5.
Yeah, never.
So that's something I think that's really actionable that anybody can do. It's probably not front of mind, but I think it could have the biggest impact on you having a successful recurring business opportunity going forward.
So my favorite one, just so you know, was the as an Airbnb user, right? Someone who stays, is the smart TV.
Oh yeah,
I thought that if you share that one really quickly, I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah, look, I think in today's world, having a smart TV, well, first of all, I don't think they make TVs that aren't smart, but I think it's really important. That's another tip that I say is that, you know, there's certain amenities that are important and certain ones that are less important. And I think a lot of people spend money in the wrong places. But like, call your cable provider, call Fios, call whatever, spend $19 more on getting high-speed internet so that you can have a smart TV that streams Netflix and YouTube and all of these things that people are using more and more today. And if you have to cut the cord and save $139 on cable, like, that's okay. But whatever you do, just make sure in your description of your property, you're really, really clear, because you don't want somebody who wants to watch like the football game and it must be on ESPN staying at your place. That causes a problem, right? So that's another tip that I suggest, which is whatever your weakness or your liability is or whatever you like, you know, are uncertain about, don't hide it. And if possible, turn it into a positive, right? That eternal optimism. So for instance, if you have like, there's somebody asked a question on our YouTube channel the other day. It was like, I have a cat. What do I do about that? And I said, well, definitely make sure everyone knows you have a cat. But more importantly, why don't you advertise your place as like for cat lovers?
Right, yeah.
Get your tribe there, right? Like your tribe there with the cat, they're going to give you a 5-star review because they love your cat.
Right.
The wrong person who's not sure about cats or was surprised about cats would be like 2 stars.
Right. They'll be mad when they get there, actually.
So
I love it. That's great. I know we're running out of time, but I want to ask you a little bit more about the 15-year plan. Will you just cool. Can you give us a highlight of what that's about and how you think about it?
So I very high level, I started to realize a while ago, probably as I lost my job and thought about income and, you know, being an entrepreneur is very variable. You can have a good quarter, a good year, a good business, a bad business. And I started to realize also that, you know, because of advances in medical science and in health and in wellness and nutrition, we're all living longer. And so the combination of like, variable income and longer lifespan, I quickly looked at this and said, I don't want to work until, you know, I die. I want to make sure that I'm healthy and fit to do the things that I want to do. And so I started to think about opportunities. And that's, you know, again, I got paid handsomely at the Blackstone Group and at Ramius Capital Group to look forward and find opportunities, the best risk-adjusted reward. And I quickly came to, and quickly, you know, these, I say quickly, probably when I had the idea, it was quick, but it could have taken a year of that sort of like, is Richard working and he's sitting on the golf? Yeah, like he's on the, you know, he's on the chairlift. It came to me that I need to have some steady stream, diversified income that could also appreciate in value, like the homes could appreciate in value and they generate, you know, income every day, every week. And then I was thinking about, well, I also want to enjoy these places and what my why is. They have to have meaning to me. So when, like, for instance, I have a home down in Alabama in Mobile Bay and Hurricane Nate just came and trashed the pier and the boathouse. Yeah. If I was doing this for the wrong reasons, I'd be like, forget it, sell, I'm out. But you know what? Like, I really like that place.
Right.
I enjoy
right.
spending time there. I'm going down there in a couple of weeks, even before the hurricane, to just like think. And so I came up with this idea that if I had enough of these properties, if I could reinvest the income and pay them off in 15 years, that at a certain point, that's like the retirement fund right there. And it's just a great fortune that we're at the lowest time in 15-year mortgage rates. We're going into a rising rate environment. I like the fixed mortgage. If you're going to go out and take one, I recommend taking a fixed one right now. And even though we're at all-time highs in real estate, we're at all-time highs at the stock market. And I think that there's more risk in the stock market than in the real estate market. So I'm quite comfortable with that. And the thing about real estate is like you can affect the outcome. I can make it short-term. I can make it long-term. I can sell it. I can fix it. I can expand it. I can do whatever. There's not much I can do. I mean, as many Apple devices as I buy, I'm not really affecting the Apple outcome. And this is sort of like entrepreneurial. I can control the outcome. I have a say in the destiny. And at the same time, I'm looking at it far enough forward that like any given week or month or quarter of income doesn't really matter because my why is 15 years forward when I own these things outright.
Mm. I love the long-term vision of it. And I would also add to that that you're doing it by tapping into a market that is how we are living now. So to your point about Uber and Airbnb earlier, we're going to be doing that from here on out. And we're going to be staying in these places and sharing our homes and using our cars as income. And that's here to stay. That's not a trend that you're just jumping on to only have to jump off of.
No. And by the way, I think we're in the very early stages, right? Like even though everybody's heard of Airbnb, very few of the people that you actually know are hosts. And some percentage of the people you know have stayed in an Airbnb maybe once or twice. But the theory that I have is that everyone you know is going to be a host at some point, and everyone you know is going to have stayed in an Airbnb at some point. And so if you think about like the growth there, it's many X. It's multiples. It's not like, oh, we're, the eighth inning and there's one more inning to go.
Do you think that's just because it hasn't spread yet and it's still with the early adopters? Or is it there's some type of hurdle that we just haven't gotten over yet?
Well, I still think it's early days. Like Uber faced the following concept. I live here in New York City. I'm in ground transportation. And I remember, in 2012, 2013, people would say, I'm not getting into a random person's car. There's no chance. And like, if you ask them, would you put your kid in there? They were like, no way. And I wrote a blog probably 2 years ago that really got a lot of distribution in the limousine and ground transportation space where I said, my kids just had their, I don't know what it was, 13th birthday party or whatever it was at the time. And no parents came to pick up at 10 o'clock at night. Instead, every single kid
pulled out their phone, really?
And they all called Uber, literally. And like, for me, that's when the light bulb went off, which was like, wow. Oh my gosh, how crazy is this? Like, every single teen did it, not one or two, every single one. And those kids aren't changing. They're not going to say like, I'm 15, let me go buy a car and I'd like to have this beater car and drive it. Like they may never learn to drive, literally. Some people will need to drive and they live in remote places or they'd like to drive. But there's a concept here that if you're in an urban environment, like you may never ever learn to drive.
So I mean, really, it's like that aspiration of, I need to own my own home outright. This is my home, my space. And, I know I've arrived when I own my car and, it's my thing and I can drive everywhere have kind of been stripped away.
Right. But so now imagine this concept. Not that I need to own my own home to lay claim to like my territory or my nest. How about I'm going to live rent free? Right. Like,
it's going to actually generate income.
Yeah. Somebody else is going to buy my house for me. In fact, I'm working with a fraternity brother of mine and he was listening to this and he was like, you think I could rent out my place? And I was like, yeah, you travel, you vacation. Right. So he went and started experimenting this summer and he's also divorced. He has half custody of his kids, 1 week on, 1 week off. And on his week off, he Airbnb'd his home and took those proceeds and traveled somewhere he wanted to go. Like he listened to exactly what it is that I said. He came back and he was like, Richard, you've changed my life. My lens is completely different. I can't believe that somebody else is going to pay me to go travel and do what I want to do.
It's incredible. And I hope for those people listening out there that you are as inspired as I am to really rethink your strategy for how you use the things that you own and the possibility for actually being an entrepreneur and making money off of the things you already have. You don't even have to create a new business.
That's the beautiful thing, right? Like I said earlier, everyone has a roof over their head. Even if you don't have a spare bedroom or a spare couch or, Charles has a sixth floor walk up and he spent, $800 on a fold out couch. And yeah, his life's changed. He sometimes has a guest in his place, but you know what? Basically lives rent free.
Well, and to your point, right? You have a long-term vision of 15 years. So if you look at the long-term vision of what you're trying to accomplish and your why, not being in your home for a couple nights every now and again is totally worth it.
And I think one thing that you pointed out and it bears mentioning is one of the advantages that we had when I was a hedge fund investor was that we had long-term money, right? Like people locked up their money with us. So it allowed us to look forward and make longer-term bets. And the most successful person that I've ever known who has that forward-looking vision is Jeff Bezos at Amazon.
Yeah.
The only reason he is so successful, besides being brilliant, is the fact that he was able to convince Wall Street that his vision of like not making any money could go on like for years, decades, in order to like own the monopoly.
Yeah.
But before him, everyone else was managing to like the quarter, right? Like, yeah, we need to turn a profit now. And if he was managing to the quarter, Amazon would be a small fraction of what it is today. But because he had this long-term vision and he bought himself that runway, and even though there was a lot of skeptics and naysayers, he just kept to it. He's built like, I mean, he's transformed the way that people will shop forever.
He has. And, you know, with the recent purchase of Whole Foods, it's going to change food and food delivery and how we get our food. And I mean, it's just incredible what they've done.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And again, you know, it comes back from having that different lens, buying yourself time, convincing yourself that you are right. And like you can, if you're wrong, it's okay. But like going out there on that limb and innovating and not just doing what Wall Street says. You're a public company. We need quarterly reports. You know, how many quarters in a row did he report losses?
Yeah.
And he didn't care.
Yeah, it's incredible. And you know, the other thing I'd say for launch readers out there that I'm really loving about this interview is that, you know, we look at the cover of Fast Company or Inc. magazine, success magazines, and we see the 20-year-old with a hoodie and we're like, that's an entrepreneur. I have to aspire to that, right? I have to, you know, come up with some disruptive technology that's going to, you know, be game-changing and blah, blah, blah. But you don't have to be what all those other things are to be an entrepreneur. You can use what you have and create a really good life out of it.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it all leads to a variety of different things. You know, some of the detractors in my story will say, well, you know, he was successful before and that allowed him to do this, that, or the other. And that's why he can do YouTube. And, you know, okay, fair enough. But you know what? Like, I hustled to be successful.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
This wasn't like, you know, I just was born into this and it is what it is. It was like, no, no, no. I busted my butt to take care of that and that and that and put myself in this position.
Well, my argument to that too is twofold. One is, first of all, isn't it the American dream to be able to have the resources for yourself and for your children, right? For your legacy, so that they don't have to suffer the way you did, or so that, you know, you can do the things that you'd like to do. So to me, there's absolutely nothing wrong if you start with a little bit of resources and you turn it into more because you hustle. The second thing I'd say is there's a lot of examples out there of people who came from nothing as well. So it's all possible if you believe it, and where you're starting is, it's not that it's irrelevant, but it's not the whole story.
No, and I think the last message that I would leave with people is we're so unaware of the fact that we have a lens, right? Like think of a contact lens. Each one of us has a contact lens in, and we don't see it. We don't even know it's there. We're like, we don't realize it. But imagine taking those lenses out and putting a different lens in, an entrepreneurial lens, a risk tolerant lens, a risk loving lens. Like one of the things that I think differentiates me from a lot of my friends and family and so on is like, I actively seek and embrace risk. It's a competitive advantage for me, my relationship with risk. Right.
And
now that I know that, I can actually embrace it. It doesn't mean like I'm a gambler. I don't even gamble at all. It just means that the kind of things that scare people away, I'm attracted to, and I find opportunity in that.
And it's such a powerful place to be because you're willing to go where other people won't.
And generally there's opportunities, right?
Yeah. That's the beautiful part.
So
I can't even believe we've gone so far over, but it was such a good conversation. Where should people go to learn more, connect with you?
So you can go to my website, which is www.richardfertig.com, which is sort of like a landing page. It'll point you to all the different things that we do. I also write for Forbes, and I've got this YouTube channel and a few other businesses. So I think that's a good starting point. But probably the most relevant place if you really want to get started on this Airbnb, whether it's like just getting started or improve it or even grow it. We have a lot of people that you know, have multiple properties that pay attention to what it is that we're talking about, is go to our YouTube channel, which is Short-Term Rental Secrets.
Awesome. So and we'll put a bunch of those links in the show notes too. So people don't have to pull over while they're driving and try to write it down.
That's a great thing. Yeah. We don't want people to see, but like in a few years, you'll be like in an electric
That's
Uber.
Right. I won't have to say that anymore.
Exactly.
My last question for you is, what's the one thing people would be surprised to learn about you? It could be hobby, passion, experience.
I don't know if they would be surprised per se, but maybe it'll get some excitement. I'm a really, really avid skier. I love to ski steep and extreme stuff. And, you know, we talk about risk. It's the kind of thing where...
Well, no wonder.
Yeah. I just love skiing. I love being outdoors. And I'm really excited to go to Jackson Hole, which is considered one of the most extreme and best ski areas like in the world. And I'm planning on skiing, I think it's like almost 60 days this winter.
Do you have a favorite place?
To ski in Jackson?
Yeah. Or no, in general, just around the world.
Well, I was born in Costa Rica. It's special to me. I absolutely love it. I did a 55-day epic tour this summer, and the highlight there was the 30 days I spent in Bali, and that actually led to a development site. So now I'm working with partners, and we're developing an eco-village, wellness, health, spiritual, agriculture,
Bali.
Like amazing, right?
Yeah.
And again, it's like you got to go and you got to open your mind. And I've never done an international deal. I've never done a partnership before, but that doesn't mean that I shouldn't. And now I am.
Well, that goes into your whole leaning into risk, doesn't it?
Yep, exactly.
Well, Richard, thank you. I feel like we could talk on and on. So we're going to have you back and dig into all the questions I couldn't get to. But thank you. This was an incredibly insightful conversation that I know our launch readers are going to get a ton out of.
Awesome. Well, I really appreciate your time and your readers or listeners' time, and I'd love to come back. So, and if you have any questions, anybody, come over to the YouTube channel, post a comment, join our Facebook group. There's tons of really smart people that can help us all.
Do you want to say what the YouTube channel is really quickly? I think I accidentally cut you off saying show notes. So say what it is so we don't miss it.
Yeah. So the YouTube channel is Short-Term Rental Secrets.
Okay. Got it. Excellent. This was fantastic.
Awesome.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on GoToLaunchStreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. GoToLaunchStreet.com.